Today, from the Wings Archives, here's radical feminist author Marilyn French. French's wildly popular first novel, The Women's Room, came out in 1977. Before her death in 2009, she had published at least 29 books in several languages. This 1990 speech at an international women's conference draws from her nonfiction book, Beyond Power, on women, men, and morals. Late Wings co-founder Catherine Davenport recorded, edited, and hosted this two-part series. The original Wings sound logo was created by Maggie Payne.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. This is part one of two half-hour programs on Marilyn French, recorded at the First World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power, held in Montreal, Quebec. Marilyn French.
All of us here in this room know that we are living through an experience unprecedented in history. The written record of the human past is replete with examples of violence and destruction. But not until our era did we possess the means to annihilate our race. Yet with all this power, we have no vision for our future beyond ideas for further technological miracles.
Marilyn French is the author of two works of literary criticism and three novels. In 1985, Summit Books published her book titled Beyond Power, a scholarly work on women, men, and morals. On June 6, 1990, Marilyn French presented a paper based on her book, Beyond Power.
We don't dwell on the future because it doesn't bear thinking about. All imaginable scenarios are terrifying and dreadful. The future may contain nuclear war, which could eradicate not just human, but all life. Or we may pollute the planet irrevocably, and like many species before us, become extinct. Unlike other species, however, we will take with us into extinction the nature we have poisoned. A measure of our despair is that the most positive scenario we can envision is a totalitarian world in which everything is controlled, regulated, regimented, in which order imposed by force creates a grim parody of human harmony. The machinery to accomplish these three potential futures is already in place and daily grinds out new tools to bring them closer. Now, a failure in vision is essentially a moral failure. A morality is a context of values based on a sense of what it means to be human, and a notion about the relationship humans ought to maintain with their environment, which we call nature. The morality of our society, indeed the morality that has informed the civilization of the West for about 5,000 years, is based on the belief that to be human is to be male. And to be male means to be in control of nature. That is, the proper human relation with nature is domination, the dominion over fish, flesh, and fowl that God grants men in the book of Genesis. An ideology that exalts domination, control, power, and demeans and even vilifies nature distorts human experience. All experience arises from nature, intellect, as well as body. Control over nature is, we are discovering, impossible. Nor is such control a defining characteristic of humans. There are animals which exert controls over their environment, like bees, beavers, chimpanzees. And there are human societies which try not to, like a people called the Hazda, who live in Africa and who are so careful and so reverent for nature that if they want honey, they will only break off a small piece of the hive. They take the whole hive. If they only broke off a small piece, the bees would come back and build a new hive there. But they take it all, not wanting to affect the bees' future choices. Even as it distorts experience, Society insists lies are truth. And so accustomed are we to its truths that we don't question them. We accept the dictum that flesh and its needs are debased to the point where we need psychotherapy to teach us to remember how to recognize what we feel. We continue to try to master nature to the point where its demise is foreseeable. For instance, an article in the New York Times about 4 years ago just passed over without a ripple, suggesting that two-thirds of the drinking water in the country is contaminated. We continue, in the face of contradictory evidence, to consider whatever is associated with the masculine more valuable than what is associated with the feminine. We look down on things associated with the feminine: body, emotion, childbearing, child-raising, gooey, messy things, sexual abandon, or any abandonment of control. We do not question what is gained by asserting the supremacy of mind over body. Why? When science and psychology daily produce evidence showing the interconnection of body and mind, do scientists and psychologists, among others, continue to separate them? We know that for millennia, women were identified with nature and the bodily miracle of procreation. What is gained by arguing that mind is superior to body is a basis for claiming male superiority to females. From personal need, men have created a morality which all of us accept. In our thrust to transcend body, emotion, and earthly matters, we show that we believe that it is possible for one human being to be superior to another, for humans to be invulnerable. Seeking the transcendent, the eternal, the fixed, that which can triumph over nature and the flux of time, we sacrifice the flux, experience itself. We have been taught that life has a purpose beyond itself, that we must accomplish something, leave something behind to testify to the fact that we existed. This is more important to us than experiencing our lives. So we sacrifice our lives to some unreachable goal, and our children's lives to wars dedicated to unreal goals. Loathing our mere animal humanness, we let our blood to purify ourselves of it and to prove that we are superhuman. If we continue as we are going, all we will leave behind to testify forever to human power is an inert globe. Many of us believe there ought to be another way of living, and perhaps we even catch occasional glimpses of it, but feel helpless to try to realize it. All of us must sometimes ask, how does it happen that a few men in positions of power can carry the entire human race into Armageddon against its will? It doesn't seem possible. And it isn't possible. We all participate in making our society what it is. Our world reflects our values. We contribute to society's headlong rush toward disaster and will continue to do so until we become conscious of how and why we are doing so. In the hope that we can find our way to a positive, desirable future, I want to talk to you about some of the ideas contained in my book, Beyond Power, on women, men, and morals. This book is concerned with the origin of our present morality, its effects, and ways of changing it. I have to go back a little bit in history. Some form of human being has occupied this planet for at least 3.5 million years. In deluded pride, we reserve the name human for our own species, Homo sapiens, and call earlier versions humanoids or hominids. Many varieties of hominids evolved over the millennia. All walked upright, had an opposable thumb, and a brain slightly larger in proportion to body mass than that of other animals. Some hominids, like The Neanderthals, for example, were very intelligent. Humans emerged in Africa, but traveled. It took about 2.5 million years for them to reach the Middle East and Java. With another 500,000, they were established in Northern Asia and Europe. Homo sapiens probably evolved between 100 and 200,000 years ago. And over all those millennia, humans or proto-humans lived at peace. There is no sign of weapons being used by humans against humans, despite your being trained on a mythology of cavemen dragging cave women by the hair. There's no sign of groups being slaughtered, no sign of war, until about 10,000 years ago. Fragmentary evidence exists by which anthropologists can reconstruct the life of early hominids. Architectural remains, fragments of early tools and pottery, fossil bones and teeth. Students have observed the customs of about 200 societies that at the turn of the century still lived by gathering, hunting. I think there are very few of these left now. They've also observed the social arrangement of other mammals, especially our closest kin, the chimpanzee. Chimpanzee DNA and human DNA is so similar that it's almost impossible to tell them apart, even under a microscope. They vary only in one element out of every 100. Chimpanzee mothers take their infants with them everywhere. The babies cling to the mother's body hair as she moves through the forest foraging for food. At 1 or 1.5, the young can move by themselves, but they remain for the most part with their mothers until they mature. Females mature at 13, males at 15. A mother nurses her infant for 5 years. She shares with it the food she forages. She holds her baby. She rocks it. She crouches over it to keep it dry in the rain. She grooms it. And in time, it will groom her, too. Grooming is the major way these animals show affection. At night, the mother and her young sleep together in a nest she has built. Over the years, she teaches them what to eat and when, what routes to take through the forest, what plants or insects or conditions are dangerous, how to build a nest, and how to make tools like the stripped twigs female chimps use to gather termites, which is a great delicacy for them. Females teach the young to discriminate among the varied elements of their environment and to share food and affection. In other words, females teach the entire species what they need to survive. Adult males forage mainly for themselves. Sometimes they share food with females, or nurture an infant, or groom a female. And of course, the male is essential to procreation. But the female chimpanzee takes responsibility for most of what is necessary for the survival of the species. Hominids probably lived in a similar way at first. Since hominid young could not grasp body hair, they had to be carried. Now that's a problem. To solve it, females probably invented containers made of bark and leaves that carried their infants and eventually adapted them to other purposes. With containers, females could gather rather than forage. There's a big difference between the two. When you forage, you spend I've forgotten the exact statistics, but I think adult female chimpanzees, either pregnant or with babies, spend 80% of their waking hours just looking for food. When you gather, if you have a container, you put it on your head, you fill it with water, you put a piece of fern in it, and that keeps the water from sloshing. And then you can walk 3, 5, 7 miles, however far you have to walk, to the area where you can gather. As you walk, you drink the water, and you begin by foraging. That is, you collect a fruit, a nut, you dig up a vegetable, you eat it. Foraging is gathering and eating at the same time. Once the basket's empty of water, you start to fill the basket. That's gathering. You walk back to the clearing, and the next day, you have off. Women in present-day gathering societies provide between 80 and 90% of the food of the entire society, not just for themselves and their children. And they work an average of 3.5 days a week. Don't ever believe them when they tell you we've made progress. Containers also made migration possible, since a group could carry food and water with them over long distances through unfamiliar territory. The intelligence of these creatures led them to alter their way of life over the millennia. They began to use sharp stones to dig roots. They improved their tools so they could chop and slice roots and vegetables. If you go to a museum that hasn't updated its exhibits, they will show you all these very ancient bits of stone and tell you they're arrowheads. They are not. They're slicing tools. Because they began to slice roots and vegetables, the huge chewing teeth that humans used to have began to vanish. In us, you know, we still get these, what they call wisdom teeth, sometimes. Sometimes they still reappear, they have to be taken out. For the first 1.5 million years of their existence, hominids lived on vegetables. They had meat only occasionally, when someone trapped a small animal in her hands or his hands. Projectiles did not appear until 1.5 million years ago. That means hunting did not begin until proto-humans had lived on Earth for 2 million years. In this time, hominids harnessed fire, built boats, created art, rituals, ceremonies. We don't know when they first began to use language, but since the ability to speak is learned early in life or not at all, language had to evolve from communication between young hominids and their mothers. Unlike other mammals, chimpanzees live in societies. There are some which do, but most mammals live in all-female societies, lions and elephants. They kick out the adolescent males when they reach adolescence, and the poor males are doomed to wander solitary for the rest of their days. Anthropologists generally agree that hominids, like chimps, were friendly and sociable and lived in small egalitarian groups bonded by affection. The primary bond was between mother and children, but sisters and brothers are also close. Among other large animals, I already said this, mothers cast their sons out of the group. It's likely that hominid behavior was closer to chimp behavior rather than to lion or elephant behavior. Males would leave the maternal group at puberty, attach themselves to a female in another group. Men had to break their bond to their mothers to form one with mates. Women did not. They remained with their mothers and sisters throughout their lives, mothers and aunts and sisters. It is doubtful that anyone recognized the male role in procreation. Brothers probably treated their sisters' children as their own, as they still do in some simple societies. The bond between mates was physical, emotional, and practical, not political. And therefore, it was changeable at will. Yet in simple societies about which we have information, most unions seem to be happy. Societies organized in this way are called matricentric. There's center life around mothers, but mothers do not dominate. They are not matriarchal. We hear that term thrown around an awful lot. When you write about these things, you have to be very precise. Matriarchy, the root of that word is arche, the Greek word which means leader or head. Patriarchy means men dominate. Matriarchy would be women dominate. Patriarchy is men dominate women and other men. Matriarchy would be women dominate women and other men and all men. No such society has ever existed. There have been societies in which women had a great deal of power, but never in all of recorded history have women attempted to do what men do to women from the beginning of the first state, which is extend authority over them, pass rules and regulations saying what they may or may not do. Never. So females were probably seen as favored by nature, possessed of a miraculous ability to give birth autonomously. The greatest values in matricentric societies were bonds of blood and affection, sharing, and fruitfulness. Humans saw themselves as participants in nature, one species among many. Conflict was resolved, as it still is in many simple societies, by one of the opponents leaving the group. The matricentric world sounds idyllic, and anthropologists who've studied societies that retain some matricentric ways report that they are happier and more harmonious than our own. And matricentric values enabled our race to survive for 3.5 million years, something Homo sapiens, we, may not achieve. We've only been around for 100 to 200,000. But something happened to change this way of life. If we examine matricentric societies and the social organization of the more complex mammals, we will see that in both, females take most of the responsibility for what is necessary for the survival of the entire species. I've already mentioned that women in gathering societies provide 80 to 90% of the group's food. They do all the food processing. They give birth to and tend the young. They build the shelters. In ancient societies, women decided when they would move and where they would move and what direction they would take. In many of these societies, women fish, hunt, and manufacture objects for use or sale. Men occupy a marginal role. They spend less time hunting or fishing than the women do gathering, and they're not always successful. Men frequently sit around the settlement making or polishing weapons, gambling, gossiping, and tending the children. This is true even in societies in cold regions, up in northern Canada, which are dependent upon meat for survival and which men do almost all the hunting. Given the marginal position of men in early societies and the unreliability of the hunt, because no matter how skilled the hunter, if he returns empty-handed, if the game is not running, it's possible that men sometimes felt inferior to women. Perhaps to offset this inferiority, men invented cults dedicated at first to the mistress of a hunt. And there's a really extraordinary cave painting in France that shows a man naked, standing with a bow and arrow, about to shoot. The line, there's a line drawn on the painting from his hand to his penis, and between his legs, out to the mistress of the hunt, and straight to her, you know what. So you know where the power was coming from. Her vulva, I'll use a polite word. All hunting societies have male cults, and use ritual and symbol in an effort to control nature, to reinforce the relation between men and plants or men and animals. If the hunt is controlled by a god, men are not responsible for its failure, and they can best improve their take by placating or bribing the god. Men in hunting societies devote much of their time to cultic rituals and to manufacturing objects for use in those rituals. Also, women are excluded from those rituals. Not until very late did the gods of such cults develop into high gods. A high god is not local, and it's transcendent. A transcendent power stands above and apart from what it controls. It's an unmoved mover, which can affect humans or nature without being affected in return. Isn't this the dream of power that we have? Transcendence is the most unrealistic conception humanity has ever devised. It expresses a wish, not an actuality. Despite the many symbolic methods humans have devised for appearing to be impervious to nature, in reality there's no way to negate the hold of nature on the human body-mind. And despite humanity's best efforts, it is impossible to manufacture an artificial environment to substitute for nature without running the risk of destroying nature. Transcendence, then, is quite literally death. Recent experiments with subatomic phenomena show that neither transcendence nor domination exists at that level. At that level, all phenomena are interrelated. For centuries, humane thinkers and writers have taught us that all things are connected, that all bells toll for all of us, that transcendence in the long term is not a human possibility. All humans have been able to achieve is the appearance of transcendence, trappings of rank and office that create the appearance that a powerful man can affect things without being affected by them. There's only one act, human act, that can really be called transcendent, and that's the male role in generation. Male insemination of a female can be the act of an unmoved mover, of one who sets in action an event that does not affect him. If a man does not care about the woman he impregnates, the child he fathers, or the continuation of the human race. I believe that discovery of the male role in procreation linked itself to the desire for a transcendent God who bore the responsibility for the results of the hunt and created a new religion, a religion that worships control. No life can be made up entirely of pleasure, nor does valuing pleasure eliminate pain. But it stands to reason that if we made decisions according to what would bring us pleasure rather than what would bring us power, we would more often feel satisfied. A society that valued pleasure would place priority on the well-being of its people. Despite many manifestos and declarations of independence, no such society has ever existed within history. Ours may be an ultimate choice. We may choose to be the last civilization to occupy this globe, or the last society offering any shreds of human freedom, or the first society in which all people take responsibility for providing the necessary, share equal powers, and consciously dedicate themselves to felicity. Whether or not we try to influence its direction, the world will change. As I mentioned earlier, some animals exercise controls over their environment, and some humans try to avoid doing so. But all creatures exercise some forms of control over bodily functions and behavior. But just as there is a distinction between power to, or ability, and power over, or domination, there's a difference between practicing control and worshiping it. To worship control means to value it for its own sake. To try to control a child by teaching it, scolding it, or even shouting at it not to run in the street is to practice control. To force a child, to teach a child to sit absolutely still and silent whenever you snap your fingers is to value control for its own sake. People who worship control like to display their wealth or authority, and in cultures that worship control, such displays earn them status. A man who humiliates and bullies his employees may be damaging his company's efficiency and inventiveness, but he retains high status even among those who fear and hate him.
You've been listening to part one of 2 half-hour programs on author Marilyn French, recorded in Montreal, Quebec, June 6, 1990, at the First World Summit on Women and the Many Dimensions of Power.
That was the late Wings co-founder Catherine Davenport. I'm your surviving co-founder, Frieda Worden. Don't forget to tune in next week for part two of Marilyn French. It's a humdinger. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. You can find many Wings programs, old and new, by visiting our website wings.org. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.